I went through 4 sessions of chemo. We're all battling this together. It's not just myself, it's the nurses that's battling with you. The more people that help you, you beat it.
The nurses and physicians of Dignity Health believe that while medicine can cure, human kindness helps us heal, which is why it's a part of everything we do. Dignity Health. Hello, human kindness.
Jensen, folks, that's right. After the free speech radio news, and I learned how to do three-way conferencing call. No, but we got 30 minutes of free speech radio news from FSRN.org, a ear to the ground and a voice on the air, independent grassroots media from the people for the people. Free Speech Radio News. Derek Jensen on the back end.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, April 11, 2008. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The World Bank and IMF meetings kick off with little public protest. We'll hear how the opposition is organizing. Relative calm returns to Haiti's streets after mass protests there over soaring food prices. And we'll go to Italy, where Silvio Berlusconi will likely become prime minister for the third time. All that and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe has banned political rallies in the capital, Harare, ahead of planned demonstrations this weekend. He also canceled his attendance at an emergency meeting of regional leaders. Mugabe has ruled Zimbabwe without interruption since 1980, and many suspect he lost his presidency in a recent general election. Opposition leader and presidential contender Morgan Tsvangirai will attend this weekend's meeting of Southern African leaders. Nearly 2 weeks since Zimbabwe's election, the official results for the presidential race have not been announced, although election officials have lost their jobs for allegedly undercounting votes for Mugabe. In Mexico, plans to privatize Pemex, the national oil company, have sparked major showdowns inside and outside of the Mexican Congress. Leftist politicians have taken over both chambers, while their supporters camp outside of the legislative building. Vladimir Flores has more.
The three main opposition parties to the ruling PRI-PAN alliance have occupied both chambers of Congress, even sleeping there at night, to call for a debate on a dictate issued by President Felipe Calderón that would open Pemex to private foreign oil companies. Pemex is Mexico's top source of national revenue, just ahead of direct international investment and remittances sent home by Mexican workers in the U.S. Women from the Frente Amplio Progresista movement have gathered outside of Congress and set up a protest encampment which has drawn hundreds of federal police. Calling themselves the Adelitas, the women are supporters of former presidential candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Many Mexicans believe electoral fraud is what handed the presidency to Felipe Calderón in what was officially the closest race in Mexican history. Prior to his presidency, Calderón oversaw Pemex as the Minister of Energy. Calderón's dictate to open up Mexico's oil and gas reserves fell as the country marked the anniversary of the assassination of the campesino revolutionary Emiliano Zapata. For FSRN, I am Vladimir Flores in Mexico.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting that the board of directors of ExxonMobil has awarded the company's CEO a compensation package of nearly $17 million for steering the oil giant as it netted the highest profits ever for a U.S. company. This as gas hovers around $4 a gallon at the pump. Rising energy costs have also been cited as a contributing factor to rapid inflation in food prices. ExxonMobil broke U.S. business records last year when it netted over $40 billion. In other news, the Israeli army carried out separate attacks on the Gaza Strip today, claiming the lives of five Palestinian miners and two Hamas fighters. The attacks came hours after Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert vowed to deal a blow to Hamas. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more from Gaza City.
At least 10 Israeli tanks rolled into the central Gaza Strip refugee camp of Al-Burayj this morning and opened fire on local residents. The tank rounds killed four teenagers and a 10-year-old boy. 17 others were wounded, including children. It was the deadliest Israeli ground offensive this month. Earlier this morning, an Israeli drone fired two missiles into the southern Gaza Strip.
After a week of massive protests against the rising cost of food, many Haitians remain angry that Haitian President René Préval has yet to offer an immediate solution to lower prices. Reed Lindsay reports from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
The demonstrations began in the southwestern city of Okai last week. Thousands took to the streets to demand the government lower food prices. Community leader Simeon Yves Marseille was one of them.
Everything is too expensive. We're taking to the street to ask the government to change the living conditions of the people. The high cost of living has forced us to take the street.
Food prices are rising around the world, sparking protests and riots. But perhaps nowhere have they had such a devastating impact than in Haiti, the poorest country in the Americas. Since January, the price of rice has doubled. The protesters in Okai appealed to Haitian President René Préval. Community leaders demanded he roll back free market policies and create community stores with subsidized prices. But Préval did not respond. And by Monday, the protests had spread like wildfire across the country. In the countryside, farmers set up road blockades. They used boulders, tree trunks, and broken down cars. Vilner Chéri is a farmer in the town of Cavaillon.
Our children are hungry and we can't feed them. We know we have a president in this country, so we're forced to get out on the street and cry for help to the people who have the capacity to do something for us. That's why we put up the barricades to block the cars. The president must do something about this.
In Port-au-Prince, barricades of burning tires blocked roads and protesters looted and burned businesses. Much of their anger was directed at United Nations peacekeepers. Finally, on Wednesday, President Prévost responded with a televised speech.
In 1987,
when rice began being imported at a cheap price, many people applauded. But cheap imported rice destroyed locally grown rice. Today, imported rice has become expensive, and our national production is in ruins. That's why subsidizing imported food is not the answer.
Instead, Prévost promised to subsidize Haitian-grown food to encourage national production. The proposal may have struck right at the root of the problem of rising food prices, but Prévost offered no short-term solution to his people's suffering.
I thought President Prévost was going to talk about something that has importance for us today.
Luigi Santillome is an unemployed protester who was manning a barricade on Wednesday night.
President Prévost can't talk to us about agrarian reform anymore. The situation has degenerated too much.
Since Prévost's speech, the streets of Port-au-Prince have been calm. But tensions remain high, and many people from poor communities warn of more protests unless the government takes immediate action to lower food prices. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Reed Lindsay from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Italian voters head to the polls Sunday and Monday to choose a new prime minister just 2 months after the collapse of Romano Prodi's center-left government. The two main candidates from both the center-left and center-right coalitions include Silvio Berlusconi, who, according to Forbes magazine, is the third richest man in Italy, and Rome's mayor, Walter Veltroni. If Berlusconi wins, he will serve his third term as prime minister. FSRN correspondent Diletta Varlesi spoke with voters in Brescia about the upcoming election.
Bartender Vittorio Costa is serving up an espresso, but it doesn't miss a beat when stating his opinion about this weekend's elections.
I feel ashamed to let the U.S. public know that I believe there is no person that I feel represents me. Honestly, I would be tempted not to vote. But in the end, I know that tomorrow I'll wake up and go to the polls, and I have no clue who I'll choose.
On the other side of the bar, Fausto Micheli is having a red wine and replies.
We should vote. I cannot conceive of electing a person who is considered a clown by international opinion. I cannot even say his name. You're talking to someone who's worked in a steel factory for 39 years. Who do you think I'll vote for? My heart would vote for the Communist Party, and my vote will choose not to have Berlusconi again. So I choose the lesser evil.
Berlusconi's main rival is Walter Veltroni, secretary of the newly born PD party, or Partito Democratico. Veltroni was former mayor of Rome and campaigned as the leader of the center-left coalition after Prodi's government collapsed last February. Silvio Berlusconi, at 72 years old, is running for the center-right coalition, known as PDL, or People of Freedom. Forbes magazine recently downgraded Berlusconi to the third richest billionaire in Italy, but that has not diminished his influence. He still owns 80% of Italian media outlets, three major national construction holdings, and the soccer team Milan FC. Francesco Zambelli is a journalist specializing in Italian politics. He was at a bookshop.
I think the situation in our country is very difficult, especially because everybody is talking about economics, but I think that the real debate is in a certain sense misled, because in Italy there are many resources that are destined to the wrong aims. The money spent for a military mission in Afghanistan or to sustain the Vatican Church are really bad spent.
According to pollster, Berlusconi is 5 points ahead of Veltroni. By Friday at midnight, the electoral campaign will be closed and the distribution of all political propaganda must cease until the vote is over. 47 million people out of 60 million are eligible to cast ballots this weekend. Immigrants, however, are not allowed to vote unless obtained citizenship through marriage by living in a country for more than 10 years or if they come from some Eastern Europe countries recently included in EU, such as Romania. International observers and commentators from the Financial Times and The Economist are warning that Berlusconi is not suitable to lead the country, while other outlets are painting a much more favorable picture. Flavio Bonardi is a candidate for Berlusconi's party in local administrative elections.
Io ho piena fiducia in Berlusconi sia come prima come imprenditore e poi.
I completely trust in Berlusconi, first as a businessman and secondly as a politician. Surely he cannot completely change the country. He's not a magician and he has no magic wand. But I think that in his life he showed that he's really capable of obtaining what he wants.
Mara De Feo is a doctor and a declared right-wing voter.
I think anything will be changed because right and left are the same people, and they are against each other.
Election results are expected to be released on Monday night. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Diletta Varlese from Brescia, Italy.
The World Bank and International Monetary Fund are holding their spring meetings in a calmer environment than in years past. No protests are blocking the streets, and the meetings are going on without a hitch. But that doesn't mean that the opposition is silent. FSRN's Tanya Snyder has more from Washington.
The World Bank is focusing its spring meetings on world development indicators that show economic growth, especially among developing nations. Program manager Eric Swanson summed up the big picture.
Development is happening, economies are growing, and people are healthier, but we are also beginning to face enormous challenges for sustainable and inclusive growth.
Alan Gelb, acting World Bank chief economist, said that between 2000 and 2006, developing countries' share of the global economy rose from 35% to 41%.
The developing economy is rapidly becoming a very significant part of the overall global economy.
But he acknowledged that inequality between the haves and the have-nots is still a matter of life and death for the have-nots.
Women in low-income countries say have a 1 in 40 chance of dying from pregnancy-related causes. Women in high-income countries have only a chance of 1 in 6,700.
Meanwhile, environmental advocates are pushing the World Bank to focus on reducing its impact on climate change. Lucy Baker of the Bretton Woods Project criticized the World Bank's involvement in environmentally destructive fossil fuel projects.
It's estimated that the World Bank has invested over $25 billion in fossil fuel projects since 1992, when the Climate Convention was first signed.
Alan Gelb responds that these energy projects are necessary to fuel economic growth.
In some cases, there is no alternative but some use of fossil fuels, even if they do emit carbon. In terms of enabling them to grow, to provide employment, and to raise living standards. This, I think, is the hard truth of the matter.
But Steve Kretzmann of Oil Change International says that fossil fuel projects are nothing more than a profitable investment.
It's always justified in terms of energy access, even though more often than not, it supports industries that are often for export, for production of goods for export to the north.
Environmentalist Lucy Baker points to a World Bank commissioned review process that recommended the bank phase out investments in oil production by 2008 and focus on renewable energy sources.
This recommendation and many others was rejected by the bank, rejected or watered down at least. And in its management response to the extractive industries review, the World Bank committed to increase its support for renewable energy and energy efficiency by 20% per year. Clearly this hasn't quite happened in the way that many of us would have hoped, because only 6% of the World Bank's energy portfolio is for genuine new renewable energy.
Lawrence McDonald of the Center for Global Development said that the issue isn't that the World Bank is such a big player in energy investment, but that they could be a leader, paving the way for other energy investors to look to renewables. When asked about the amount of the bank's investments, McDonald said that the exact figure wasn't important.
I think the important thing to understand is it's teeny, 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 tiny. You could get the bank totally out of fossil fuels and the world would not change one bit. The problem is not the projects. The problem is the lack of the bank using public money to transform the market. And as long as they're doing this other stuff, they're not playing a transformational role, because the incentives that they have internally are to process big loans.
The IMF and World Bank meetings will continue throughout the weekend. They will meet up with at least one protest. Jubilee USA is planning Global Justice Street Theater to speak out against what it calls the IMF and World Bank's predatory lending practices and to support the cancellation of third world debt. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
The Pacific Fishery Management Council adopted the most restrictive salmon season in the history of the West Coast yesterday. The restrictions are in response to the population collapse of Chinook salmon in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and the low populations of coho salmon from Oregon and Washington. Christina Honestad has more.
The PFMC, Pacific Fishery Management Council, makes recommendations for the West Coast fishing season, and the Federal National Marine Fisheries Services implements them. Calling it the worst year ever, the council adopted a complete closure of commercial and sport Chinook salmon fishing in California and most of Oregon. The council's limiting fishing for coho salmon in central Oregon as well, due to the species' low population. The state of California is estimating a $255 million loss to its economy this year. Ben Platt, a commercial salmon fisherman in Northern California, estimates an 80% loss of income. He says a no salmon season is a Band-Aid solution.
Cutting back ocean fishing will not solve the problem or even minimize further damage, because if the fish aren't there, you don't catch them.
Fishermen and environmentalists say dams and water diversions are to blame for the Chinook salmon's population collapse and the coho salmon's dwindling numbers. Barry Nelson with the Natural Resources Defense Council says swift action needs to take place before salmon disappear.
The first thing we need to do is provide adequate flows in our rivers and in the delta in order to keep salmon healthy. We need to make sure that the areas they spawn in have enough cold water so that we don't literally cook those young salmon. We need to remove barriers to fish migration, like Red Bluff Diversion Dam that literally blocks the Sacramento River at times. And in the delta, we need to restore enough habitat so there's actually food for young salmon as they migrate out to the ocean. Those four things we know how to do. The problem is we haven't been managing our rivers in order to protect salmon. We've been managing our rivers in order to provide more and more cheap water for Central Valley agriculture. That's where 80% of the water in California goes.
According to the Fishery Management Council, salmon catches off the coast of California and Oregon averaged over 800,000 Chinook per year from 2000 to 2005. This year, the council estimates, even with all ocean salmon fishing closures, the return of fall Chinook to the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta will be 54,000. The National Marine Fisheries Services has until May 1st to approve the council's recommendations. I'm Christina Onested reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
It's been a tough few weeks for Chile's farmed salmon industry, which has been challenged on its labor practices and accused of damaging the environment, including charges that heavy use of antibiotics is putting consumers' health at risk. FSRN's Jorge Garretón explains from Santiago, Chile.
Last week, the Safeway supermarket chain announced it would stop carrying Chilean salmon due to health concerns.
The New York Times published a story exposing serious environmental problems in the salmon industry. Then it was announced that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, will be inspecting salmon farming practices on site. The industry says the FDA visit was scheduled long ago and is not cause for alarm. But it is harder to brush off the outbreak of infectious salmon anemia virus, or ISA virus, which has devastated southern waters and killed salmon by the thousands. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, a club Chile hopes to join, told the government that current salmon farming practices are environmentally questionable. Problems identified as far back as 2005 include farms having too many fish crowded in their pens and the pens being located too close together, creating ideal conditions for diseases. The widespread use of antibiotics and food additives is now raising alarms from buyers. According to statistics provided by the environmental organizations Ecoceanos, 54 workers have been killed on the job in the past 3 years, mostly non-professional divers who die due to repetitive diving. The industry disputes the figures, but workers are concerned about the poor management of their industry. Ecoceanos Ricardo Casas of the Salmon Workers Union, speaking from the southern port city of Puerto Montt, where the industry is based, Casas says the questions raised about his practices and the Safeway ban further threatens employment.
Bueno, es complicado para nosotros como industria. De una otra forma, vemos que...
As an industry, the current situation is difficult. You can see that our jobs are in danger due to the serious environmental and labor problems because of antibiotics and the many number of unregulated problems, and that plays against us as a workforce, so we are in a tough spot.
The industry, a mixture of local and Norwegian multinationals like the giant Marine Harvest, responsible for importing the ISA virus in fish eggs from Norway, now is threatening to fire 1,600 of its workers. Industry spokesperson Ricardo Infante says they export to markets in Asia, Europe, and North America and insist they meet all environmental and health standards.
All Chilean salmon are sold under the toughest export regulations. All of our products that make it to market comply with all the standards. We are interested in giving consumers the best product possible permanently. To that goal, the salmon industry is constantly working because we have won markets based on quality.
Infante strongly questioned the New York Times report and says they will place ads in the U.S. media to counter what he calls bad reporting. But that opinion is not shared by environmental organizations who monitor industry practices. Juan Carlos Cárdenas, the director of the environmental organizations Ecoceanos, says this industry is very peculiar.
The salmon industry is a contradiction. This industry is a giant producer and exporter and a major income earner, but it is small when it comes to its environmental, labor, and social practices. The same is true in its relationship with stakeholders in coastal communities, with inshore fishers, and civil society organized by environmental organizations. Here we have an industry that has a pioneer vision to colonize areas where there was nothing, as they say, and bring progress through their salmon and trout growing centers.
He says biological studies of fish caught near salmon cages found feed and antibiotics, confirming, says Cárdenas, that poor farming practices spilled to wild local fish. Cárdenas says the industry is undergoing a quiet shakeup, with larger companies swallowing smaller ones. He says the industry is leaving its current growing centers and moving to Patagonia and further south still, scaping their current waters and leaving behind a desolate, polluted environment, what Cárdenas calls an underwater desert. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org.
That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Tina Giese. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young, and our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. From KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado.
Speech, radio news, an ear to the ground, and a voice on the air. FSRN.org. Send them a micro donation. They would appreciate it. Independent grassroots media. I'm going to play a song, and after the song, we'll have Derek Jensen. He'll be on live, and I'm going to hook him up now. Here is Dave Rovick's song, Resistance.
It's about the savages. You can say you have a better way to live. You can call it manifest destiny. You can talk of all your civilization will give. You can say that we're a thing of history, and progress is the future you will give. You can send your armies to these mountains. You can say we'll prosper beneath. There will always be resistance. Next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose. You can say you've got to stop the communists. You can say that our ideals can't succeed. You can say that competition is the only way, and a global system based on greed. You can call yourself a Democrat. You can call yourself whatever you will. You can keep on stamping out the fires you start, so you may stay on top of the hill. There will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose. Are terrorists, madmen bent on destroying all that's free. You can say that we are building weapons as your bombers fly from sea to bloody sea. You can say you're with us or against us, and to die quietly is what we now must do. You can maintain your innocence. You can claim that you are many as you represent the few. But there will always be. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose.
is basically just a vehicle for getting people to break the law, because it's becoming increasingly easy to do, in the U.S. at least, where you can now break, well, there's a 1997-era law that Clinton passed, an anti-terrorism law, apparently, which says that if you describe an incendiary device and you say something along the lines of you think people should be using these devices more often to do things like burn shit down that shouldn't be there, then you're breaking this law and you could go to prison for 25 years. And now, you might be happy to know, in case you didn't hear already, that as of 2 months ago, any citizen or non-citizen of the United States, that being anyone on the planet, can be arrested by the U.S. authorities anywhere on the planet and kidnapped and tortured and held indefinitely without trial. And under U.S. law, that is now legal. So, welcome to the modern world. But we can, you may or may not ever be considered an enemy combatant, but you can at least easily break this anti-terror law by singing the chorus to this song with me. I wrote it for my friend Rod Coronado, who is in prison right now, and for 8 months for sabotaging a hunt of some mountain lions in Arizona. And when he gets out of prison, he's going to go to trial again for a speech he gave 3 years ago. And if he's found guilty in a jury trial, if he does a jury trial, then he could be facing a 25-year sentence, which, I don't know if that's happened any time recently, people going to prison for 25 years for giving a speech, but who knows? Who knows? Rodney Coronado was arrested for the town. Burn it down. Burn it down. That was pretty good. Kind of unenthusiastic, but we still have a couple more choruses. If you just sang that chorus thing, you just broke the law to be an eco-terrorist. Now you just gotta whack your jaw. And he who knows, by the time we have a chance to blink, whether you're a criminal might depend on what you think. But we don't like the bulldozer, we're gonna burn it down. Corporate terrorists, drive them out of town. We'll bring a lot of gasoline, pour it on the floor, light a match, say a prayer, and run right out the door. Burn it down.
Burn it down.
We're going to burn it down. Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down. First they came for Rod, maybe next they'll come for you. Let me tell you what I think all of us should do. Sing the song with me, raise your fist and caterwaul. If we fight together, they can't arrest us all. We don't like the Walmart and we're gonna burn it down. Corporate terrorists, drive them out of town. We'll bring a lot of gasoline, pour it on the floor, light a match, say a prayer, and run right out the door. Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Why don't I go to a quick piece of music here that I wanted to feature from Dave Rovix.
Were you drinking wine from Argentina or Indonesian coffee? Did you take some in a plane and go fly across the country? Did you go to work the next week, drive your daily 20 miles? Stop at Sears to see the latest Chinese styles. When you did these things, did you wonder how or why? In the years before the oil wells ran dry. Were you watching the news? Did you wonder when they'd bomb another country or start up the draft again as you tried to stop the war that might decide the planet's fate? Did you stop to question how that food got on your plate? Have you stuck your fork into that slice of pie in the years before the oil wells ran dry? When you went
went back to college to get another PhD, or you went into the studio to record one more CD. Did it occur to you that your time might be spent better digging in the earth or learning to knit a sweater? Did you prepare for all the changes, or at least pretend to try, in the years before the oil wells ran dry? When the cars and planes stopped running, and the dollar hit the floor, and the hordes of hungry children were knocking on your door, when unemployment in the streets said blame the Arabs for our plight, did you shot with dirt held high, farmers of the world unite? Did you ride an ox into town, say join the Green Revolution or die, in the years before the oil wells ran dry?
If you want to get to heaven on that some glad morning day, then you better work for justice while you're down here in the clay. 'Cause the Prince of Peace is puzzled by this war in Allah's name. Whether Christian, Jew, or Muslim, it's still killing just the same. Come down from the mountains, roll across the plains, blackened by the prairie fire, redeemed by the rain. Don't tell the dead and wounded that their suffering was in vain. Is the truth still marching on? Keep your lamp trimmed and burning, keep your hand on the plow, with your ball and your musket ready then, ready now. God bless the men and women who bear arms and serve us well. God damn their false commander who sent them straight to hell. Come down from the mountains, roll across the plains, blackened by the prairie fire, redeemed by the rain. Don't tell the dead and wounded that their suffering was in vain. Is the truth still marching on? Did we really think they'd greet us with their arms all open wide? Just because we caught Saddam doesn't mean we're on their side. And when Christian men with rifles break down Muslim women's doors, you're recruiting for Al-Qaeda, you're starting the next war. Come down from the mountains, roll across the plains, blackened by the prairie fire, redeemed by the rain. Don't tell the dead and wounded that their suffering was in vain. Is the truth still marching on? What's done is over. Where do we go from here? Can all the children of the book live in peace and without fear? Or will we go on being foolish, invading foreign lands, to add the lessons of Iraq to those of Vietnam? Come down from the mountains, roll across the plains, blackened by the prairie fire, redeemed by the rain. Don't tell the dead and wounded that their suffering was in vain. Is the truth still marching on? Come down from the mountains, roll across the plains, blackened by the prairie fire, redeemed by the rain. Don't tell the dead and wounded that their suffering was in vain. Is the truth still marching on?
Thank you. Thanks very much.
My mama rocked her baby to music that shook the block. She sang to me the sweetest songs as she checked the triple lock.
Can we please go outside now?
She said, I fear I'll lose you to the lure of cowgirl boots.
Oh, I'll believe it. Yeah.
But when you're out there all alone, my daughter, remember your roots. I wish I was back in the city. I miss my Midtown home and the dogs howling at the well.
But the call of the West was speaking to me. Adventure was there on the lone prairie. A young woman has to follow her heart. So I cry, oh lonesome.
Oh, lonesome.
Drinking Java Fog, an old tin can. Maybe the cowgirl will. But let me drink my iced cappuccino. I'm a glass at the sidewalk cafe. I wish I was back in the city. I miss my midtown home and the dogs howling at the wailing sound of sirens. Oh, why did I? Out in the West.
Hello? Hello, hello? Hello, hello? Hello, hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Derek. Oh, God.
That's all right.
Well, it's late night in Kansas. That's what happens out here.
The electronics stop working?
Not only do the clock stop working, the cows go home, brother. So.
Well,
yeah,
good.
We all go.
I wish it was everywhere.
Yeah, that's right. We all sort of we go into a deep time mode. I was so happy to finally get connected. I apologize so much for this.
Oh, that's all right.
But I'm happy we're together, and I'm happy that you're coming to Kansas. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm going to be there next.
Is it April 18th?
Friday.
Yeah.
Let's see. I mean, the thing is with these tours, basically, I'm like a horse, you know, just lead me over to the barn and then.
I know that's what I'm worried. I was worried about that. What is? Can you tell me what's going on?
Friday the 18th. I'll be at Ottawa University in Ottawa, Kansas, at the chapel. Oh shit! That means I can't swear.
Oh, you can swear. We just can't use the F word on the F. So that's the only thing we can. We can't.
Oh no, no! I was talking about when I go to Ottawa.
Oh.
I'll be in the chapel. That means I probably should hold back on some of the. I mean, I have a whole exegesis of the F word that I do.
Oh, do you really?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's great. And don't worry, I won't use it here, but it's all a patriarchy wrapped into four letters. Because it's extraordinary that the same word that means make love to means do great violence to. And that's horrible. And it's once again, it's all a patriarchy right there.
Yeah.
Well, that'll make my that one of the jokes I tell when I don't swear so much. One of the jokes I tell is that's going to take off about 20 minutes off my show.
Well, you can always swear. I'll tell you that right on this show, except for the F word, and that's only because I think the FCC. I guess there's a way you can rate this as mature. I did for the first few months I ran this show. I rated it mature just for that reason, so you could do that. But I unfortunately decided I've got to appeal to the masses out here in Kansas.
Right.
And but one of my buddies called me earlier tonight and said that they thought that it was Ottawa. I said it's Ottawa University. They were arguing,
right.
You know, that's Ottawa University. He goes, no, it's Baker. I said, no, it's Ottawa. And he's an older guy like me, and he goes, well, maybe they used to call it Baker, and now it's called Ottawa University.
I said, there you go.
Yeah. What is the reason of your tour? What's going on? I mean, it's wonderful, and we have a great struggle going on here over these coal-burning electric-generating plants in Kansas right now, but I noticed you've got an itinerary all over the country. What's going on, Derek?
Well, it's right around Earth Week, so I'm in demand. And I mean, actually, that's not true. I mean, I actually tour a lot, and honestly, that's how I pay my rent. I don't know if you know, it's a cliche of writing, which is really true, is that writing is a terrible way to make a living and a great way to make a life, and writers don't make beans for, well, they do make beans for money. That's about it. And but I also don't want to make it seem like I'm doing this simply for money, because I love doing the talks, and that part I really, really love. But I actually do, in some ways, do it for the money, because I hate traveling.
Uh-huh.
And it's just murder on my body. It destroys me. And I was asking Ward Churchill. I was asking Ward Churchill's wife how he survives traveling, because he's a bit older than I am. And I said, how does he survive? And she said, he doesn't. And I mean, it's really hard. And anyway, so that's why I'm doing it, is because a bunch of people asked, and then we worked out all the details, and then. I'm going to go around, but once again, I want to be really clear that I do love the talks themselves. It's really fun, and I really enjoy meeting the people. That's I'm probably going to be more honest than I should, but I want to put an asterisk on that I really enjoy meeting the people. I meet some extraordinary people, and the asterisk is that I'm also, and people don't know this, especially when I go on and on at my talks, but I'm actually very much an introvert, so it's great to meet the people, and then also it's also just really tiring to be out in public so much, since I am so introverted.
Well, I imagine so, and I really you have my sympathy on that, because I've done some public speaking myself, and I can't imagine having a schedule like that. That would drive me. I'd be exhausted myself.
Thing that's pretty interesting, and this is great. I mean, this is actually. I mean, I don't know what you wanted to talk about, but this is, different than most interviews. But it's pretty fun for me to talk about that. Another thing that's very interesting is that I don't drink or do any drugs or anything, but
right.
I can totally see how like musicians or whatever how they could end up doing that, because I'll get done with a gig and I'm totally wired, and then I might have to get up the next morning at 6 o'clock and catch a plane or something, but meanwhile it's I got done with the gig and it's 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm totally wired. I can see how you take something to get down, and the next morning you got to take something to get up. I can
mm-hmm.
totally see how that would end up happening.
Well, you know what? I'll be honest with you, my brother. I was sweating like a pig, and my wife is I'm making these phone calls, and my wife is like looking at me going, are you nervous? And she knows I am, and I'm having a nervous breakdown because I'm talking to Derek Jensen. I'm calling Derek Jensen. I can't get a hold of the brother, And she was like, and I happen to know that I have some brothers that are calling in right now. And speaking of, I think they want to talk to you, buddy.
Okay.
Are you down for a call?
Yeah,
I don't know these guys. It's like 1 o'clock out here, so.
I'm sure they've been staying up tonight. They have been staying up to talk to you. So, are you ready?
Okay. Sure.
All right, buddy. And I've got these special effects, sound effects. If they get real rude, just say hit it, and I'll blast them with this mortar. I got this machine gun, and I got a mortar, and I got a missile flyby, and I'll just cut them off if they get rude to
okay.
you. Okay, brother.
Okay.
All right.
Well, and you can use your judgment too.
I will. Don't worry, I will.
Okay.
I won't let them abuse you. Okay, let's see if I can hook them up here, because they're on the switchboard too.
Okay.
Let's see. Hello? 913? Hello? Oh, those guys, they might be goofing off. They've been on for like 40 minutes. Wait a minute. Hold on here.
And then after all this time, we can't hear them.
Oh, I don't know. Let's hear. Here, we have another one. I'm going to put them on hold, and I've got another call coming in right now. Hold on just a minute.
Okay.
Let's see. 785 area code. Are you there? Hello.
Hello. Who are you talking to, brother?
I'm talking. You're live. You're on the Blue Barn Radio with Derek Jensen. Derek, can you hear him?
Yep.
Hello, Mr. Derek.
Hey.
Hey, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing okay.
Oh, we're out here. How you doing, man?
I'm doing fine.
Wonderful. I'm very honored to have the opportunity to talk with you guys, and we're out here hanging out, having a good time, very interested in all the good times, the good things we're trying to do for the people in the country. And other than that, I'm interested in, we're out here, we're trying to gain interest among the people to be more self-productive. You know, we're trying to encourage people we're growing our own food and trying to get other people to do the same. And we're starting to get people to grow their own food, produce their own meat, and rely less on fossil fuels and energy and everything. And what else can we do? What else do you think would be an effective way to maybe encourage people, or another method we could do to help out in the cause, man?
Wait, Derek, just for a minute. Brian, I know this guy is my brother. Brian is my comrade. Brian, could you turn your music down a little bit, because it's sort of overwhelming?
Got it. Yeah, I got it. There you go.
Okay, Derek, go ahead.
Well, I think that everything you said that you're doing is really important, and I think that relocalizing is really crucial, and it's one of the necessary things that needs to be done. And at the same time, I think, and I'm not saying that you should do more, because we need everything, but I think that that's part of what needs to be done. And another thing that needs to be done is that this whole rotten culture that's killing the planet needs to be brought down. And so, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, if we were living in Nazi Germany and, you know, somebody was producing one's own food, so you're not reliant on the German state, is really, really important. And that's once again part of the picture. We also have to proactively stop this superculture, I mean this superstructure, from killing the planet. And
excuse me, gentlemen, excuse me. I want another person to listen in. Hold on just a minute. 913, you're live also. Please, let's observe our manners. This is Mike Cadell. You're live with Derek Jensen, and there's another caller. So let Derek talk and try to speak one at a time. Thank you. Go ahead, Derek.
Okay. But once again, I want to be really clear that we all have different roles to play. It's like I have this good friend who used to run the Battered Women's Program for the state of New York, and she's amazing. She does so much work she's really stunning. She asks every man she sees, literally, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? You get in a taxi cab with this woman, and she'll say, you know, let's go to, you know, this address, and then she says to the taxi cab driver, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? So, like, you do not want to get on a subway with this woman. She's relentless. She's wonderful. So I would never suggest to her that she do something different than what she does. And so it's the same. I mean, if you have the skills to help stem help produce food, help raise meat, or to raise other food for people locally, that's absolutely crucial. And
all right, cool.
Obviously, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm asking a question.
This is the third caller. Go ahead.
Yes, this is the third caller. What do you think about the ice shelf in the Antarctica breaking up the size of the island?
It scares the hell out of me, as does a lot of the stuff with global warming. That is, and what scares me even more is that the response by even people who care about it is really insufficient.
Let me ask you a question. Don't you think that something of that magnitude should be world alert?
A what? What did you say?
A world alert.
A world alert.
We're talking about a ice shelf, the South Island, breaking off of the Antarctic, which approximately raises the ocean levels up to 1.5 feet.
Yes. If this culture were sane, that would be the sort of thing that would be paid very close attention to. But this culture is not sane, and so we end up paying more attention to, the Seattle Mariners won tonight. They creamed the Los Angeles Angels. And too bad Kansas City lost.
Right on. We're going to pay more attention to national sports instead of national disasters.
Yeah,
I understand.
Exactly. And so,
that sucks.
What I was going to say is that one of the things that is a real problem is that the solutions, the so-called solutions presented by most people to global warming, what they do is they take industrial capitalism as a given, as that which must not be questioned, as that which must be protected, and they take the natural world, the real physical world, as secondary, and that is literally insane, because the real physical world is what's real. And it's like I was doing this radio interview in Santa Barbara, California, a couple years ago, or last year, I guess. I was a terrible, terrible interviewer, and I kept saying, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, and there's 6 to 10 times as much plastic as there is phytoplankton in the ocean, and there's dioxin in every mother's breast milk and all this stuff. I was saying all this stuff, and the interviewer kept interrupting me to say, okay, that's all fine, Derek, but let's get back to the real world. And
okay, let's get to the real world, Derek. What do you think about ostriches?
What?
Ostriches.
What? Ostriches?
Well, birds? Yes. Yeah, birds. They put their heads in the sand and put their asses up in the air and get kicked. That's sort of like a human. That's sort of like the human race.
Are you inferring that humanity's like that? Or like?
Yes, I do think that human race is like ostriches. We put our heads in the sand, put our asses in the air, and be kicked.
I think that it's up to us to help the earth kick the ass of the people who act like that, then.
Right on.
Of course. I agree completely. Let's quit beating ostriches, I'm really tired of getting my ass kicked.
Well, and that's one of the things that the whole dominant system does to all of us, is kick our asses, and it's time we stop putting up. But it's kind of like, I don't know if you get these, but once in a while I get these letters from the Southern Poverty Law Center asking me for money, and they would say, and they do good work, I'm not complaining about them, but they would say that they want me to put, to give them money, and then they'll put my name on the wall of tolerance. And I just kept sending him notes saying, you know, what I want really is for my name to be put on the wall of intolerance, because the truth is I don't think we should tolerate any of this shit that's happening right now. We shouldn't tolerate, you know, our the land and water being poisoned. We shouldn't tolerate, you know, I ask at talks, I routinely ask, how many people here have had someone you love die of cancer? And about 90% or 80% usually about say yes. And cancer, of course, is caused in great measure by the toxification of the total environment. And
well, that's just history, Derek.
In the
1800s, we didn't have that many cancers because we didn't have any chemicals.
Exactly.
Right?
And,
yeah, I agree. I agree 100%.
So, I mean, it's killing us, and we shouldn't tolerate that.
Well,
we shouldn't tolerate a system that's entirely not democratic. I mean, I used to teach at Eastern Washington University, which is a fairly conservative school, and I would ask my students, how many of you believe that we live in a democracy? And they would just laugh. I mean, of course we don't live in a democracy. We live in a system, a two-party, one-party system, where there's two rich people running against each other. And we shouldn't tolerate that. And we shouldn't, I mean, I think there was somebody a couple hundred years ago who wrote, oh God, there were these people, this guy named George, another guy named Tom, and they wrote something about taxation without representation. I don't remember.
You're talking about the founding fathers?
Yeah. You
know, the founding fathers, let's not even go on that cop topic.
Hey, Derek talk. Let Derek talk, okay, brother?
I am.
And do we have? And is the first guy still on? Because I feel like we sort of...
Yeah, I can bring him back on. Hold on just a minute. Here he comes. This is 785. Hold on just a minute. He'll be on. 785, you're live on Blue Barn.
Hey, what's
happening,
Derek?
Yeah, so I wanted to... Did you want to talk any more about the relocalization with the beef or anything, or...
Well, I was, I'm interested in it. I'm actually quite interested. Hell, I'm living it, man.
Uh-huh.
We're doing our best. We're trying to refine our canning techniques and make the food taste better and concentrating on nutritional qualities and just surviving. Mm-hmm. And, hell, I wish I'm 29 years old and I'm planning on retiring here real soon. I think it'd be pretty easy to do, actually.
Good.
Other than that, you know, I got a lot of interesting ideas about the future of our world and what is going to happen and what can we do to help direct it into more of a gentle, manageable thing for the people in our country and the people of the world. And what do you have to say to, you know, give us some direction, man?
I know.
Well, Every cell in my body wants for us to have sort of a gentle transformation, but I don't believe that's going to happen. And I mean, if we were somebody looking from the outside, I mean, we all know that oil is going to run out, and you know, peak oil is past, and all that stuff. And we all know that this whole system is based on oil. And
oh God, I can't believe that.
What?
No, we're finally here.
No, I'm being sarcastic.
Okay, sorry.
No, that's all right, Derek.
The point is that I think people looking from the outside would think that as a culture, not personally, but as a culture, we're doing everything we can to make this transformation as awful as possible because they're... We could use our cleverness to go entirely different directions, but this culture is systematically doing everything wrong. I mean, the total value of the subsidies given to commercial fishing fleets around the world is greater than the entire value of their catch. And one of the things that we would all be better off if they simply paid all those people to sit at home in their underwear and watch The Price is Right, you know? And...
they make more money.
And they make more money, exactly. Because the value of the catch, once again, is less. And so these subsidies are incredibly destructive. I mean, the oceans are being vacuumed, and the people who come after are going to inherit this wreckage. And once again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't attempt to make that transformation as gentle as possible, but I think realistically I don't think it's going to be gentle at all. And in fact, right now I think the people of Haiti would say it's not it's already happening, and it's not gentle because, you know, as you know, they're riding over food around much of the world right now, and that's going to come home very, very soon.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Hey, Derek, you have any kids?
No.
You have children?
Nope.
Nope.
That is correct. No.
Well, that's what I worry about, is that children.
Well, that's one reason I never had any.
Some of us here are not as intelligent as you, but we got some. So, you know.
I feel bad for the children. I mean, with the non-human children too, of course. And I mean, even there is so much difference between now and when I was a child in terms of the natural world, in terms of what birds sing. And where I live now, I'm going to move to another room, and if they don't stop, we can hear my neighbor. And
you're who, your neighbor?
You know, yeah, just a sec.
Oh,
sure.
Jesus.
Sure, that's okay, yeah.
Oh, of course, they were quiet. They'll start up again in a second. There, can you hear them? Oops, not quiet.
Yeah,
well,
I heard a little bit there.
They'll start talking again in a second. Anyway,
hey,
it's Brock. And there's a worldwide amphibian die-off. And, you know, in 20 years, will there still be frogs? You know, there's a real, real serious question. And what will remain? I mean, the world is, the real physical world is really falling apart. And, I mean, bobwhite populations have gone down 80% in the last 40 years. Whippoorwill populations, about 70%. Rufous hummingbird, about 70%. And,
mm-hmm.
of course, the mainstream environmentalists like Audubon say, oh, that's not a problem. That's not an emergency, they say. If that's not
I'm
an emergency,
I'm growing
them
in my front yard.
I'm sorry, what?
I'm growing some bobwhites in my front yard. I've left them alone for about the last 3 years, having babies in my front yard along
oh,
the tree line in the tall grass, and I protect them from the hunters, and I leave them be, and they're multiplying, and every year there's more and more. I was up here in northeast Jefferson County, Kansas, and
mm-hmm.
there's more and more bobwhites, and I get to hear their calls. It's beautiful.
Oh, that's wonderful. And thank you for doing that. That's also, I mean, early on, the first caller said something about, you know, what else can we do? That's a huge thing to do is to...
Yeah, that's me.
That's a very, very important thing to do is to attempt to either... rehabilitate or to not allow to be destroyed habitat. That's so important. And of course, now
Derek,
they've come outside, the frogs are quiet, but they'll start up again in a minute.
Hey, Derek, man, it's so nice to get to talk to somebody like you.
Oh, thanks.
And I, like I said, I live up here in northeast Jefferson County, Kansas, and mm-hmm. I've been helping the bobwhite quail. They sound so beautiful and they're pretty, and granted I've eaten them and they taste very good too, but
oh, we might be talking about two different things. I don't think people eat bobwhite, do they? You're thinking of because
quail
are
quail,
the same
I
thing.
Think
oh I meant quail, I'm sorry.
Okay, oh that's okay.
Quail, oh I'm sorry. Okay, I was
oh,
on
that's all right.
Well anyhow, their quail are scarce up here too, which has been a source of meat for a long time, and a lot of the folks up here have hunted them ravenously and
right.
And eradicated them, and so I'm helping to slowly bring them.
That's
I'm trying
great.
To do my part with helping bring them back.
That's such an important thing to do.
Well, now that I have the floor for a moment, I'd like to ask you another question to get your opinion about the future of our country and the world and the economy, and everything's going downhill. It's obvious. It's in the news. Even, hell, when it's on Fox 4 and it's something of this nature, they've been holding it back for a long time, and they're talking about it, and they don't want to talk about it. But the economy's going downhill, and I'm curious as to America's last trading card. When the economy collapses and we're left on our own, what are we going to have to trade with the world? What are we going to have to offer? Other than, my opinion, maybe the fact that we have good soil and we can grow food for the world, and who is going to come in to try to force us and control us to grow whose food, who's going to come into our country to make us grow food for them, or, maybe you can understand what I'm saying, or maybe you need me to elaborate, but go ahead.
No. I don't think anybody will. The reason I don't think anybody will is because of peak oil. I mean, clearly the American empire is on its way down, which I think is a very good thing. And I think that various nations can try. Oh gosh, actually no, that's okay. Stop what I'm just saying. I'm going to go in an entirely different direction for a second, which is we don't have to look at a foreign nation to talk about stealing American topsoil. I got three little initials for you, which are ADM, or how about Cargill? Or Monsanto. You know, we don't have to talk about the Chinese invading. The U.S. government's already been taken over long since, and it was taken over by Cargill, ADM, Monsanto, Shell, ExxonMobil. And so those are the ones. So there, you hear my neighbors?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, we do.
Yeah. Give it another probably 15 seconds, and I'll have to go back inside because it'll be too loud, and you won't be able to hear me.
Well, Derek, I have a question for
you. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
My question is that we know that global warming is a reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that our economy and our environment is descending fastly, very fastly, into an abyss. How can we bring it back?
Well, that's presuming that I want to bring back the economy.
How about the environment?
Well, what we have to do is the first thing that has to happen, if somebody is really, you know, if somebody's been stabbed seven times and somebody is continuing to stab them, the first thing you want to do is stop the person from stabbing them. So the first thing is to stop the additional destruction. And then the second thing is, I mean, the natural world is incredibly. Loves life a lot and loves communities a lot. And
yes.
And if it's just left the hell alone, it will start to recover. I mean, there's places that we can help, and there's a lot of ways we can help. But so far as the natural world, I mean, it depends. I mean, there's multiple levels on this. On one level, in terms of the passenger pigeons, they're gone. Sorry, it's over. Eskimo curlews, it's gone. I mean, there were flocks of Eskimo curlews in eastern Kansas. They were so large, they darkened the sky for days at a time. And people would close their eyes and aim a gun up in the air and shoot, and it hit like 17 birds. I'm not making this up.
No,
the birds
I know.
Were so fat that when they hit the ground, they would explode. And that's what the Indians there ate for a long time. And that's what the early, the first white people in the area ate too. And they're gone. And so what will...
You know the problems. You've written many books about the problems. What's the solution?
Well, there are... One of the solutions is that there's two solutions I'm going to talk about. One of them is that on one level I can't tell you the solution for the reason that I was saying before, that there are so many... I don't know what you love. I don't know your gifts. I don't know what you're good at. I don't know. I mean, all I can tell you is to use your gifts, dig in, and defend the ones you love. Defend the land you love. Defend the people you love. I can tell you that in the ways that you're best at it. And on a bigger scale, what I can say is, I mean, this culture is described accurately as omnicidal. It destroys. It kills everything. And the way Ward Churchill talks about this, and I really agree, is that we're locked in a room with a psychopath, and what are you going to do? And so the asking, what's the solution, is kind of like, so are you in a relationship?
Am I? Yes,
yeah.
I am.
Okay, so let's say you're lying in bed with your partner, and...
Well, I had a nice night, but go ahead.
Okay, you wake up and you look up and you see this axe murderer standing over you. So do you turn to your sweetie and say, "So, darling honey bunch, what's the solution?" No. If there's an axe murderer standing over you, you stop the axe murderer. And this culture is killing everything. And what do? The solution is we stop
the culture.
And
that is on so many levels. Once again, I mean, like I said, there's a friend of mine whose particular battle is that she works very hard to try to stop men from beating on women. That's one part. Another part, I know people who work so hard.
That's my girlfriend. She's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great. And then I know this guy in Pennsylvania. He does such great work on attempting to stop corporate personhood. And he's been able to. You may have heard of him, actually. He's Thomas Lindsay, and he's done great work on...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, on disallowing...
Yes, I've heard of him.
Like corporate hog factories. And other so-called factory farms from being allowed in some of those communities.
Okay, well, how do you feel about his solution?
I think that's part of it. That's one part.
Yeah.
And my point is that there are so many different ways that we need to go. I mean, there's so many different avenues to this, all of which are aimed toward the same result of stopping this culture from killing or harming those we love.
Well, of course, I agree. Because our culture is killing ourselves. We are killing ourselves inside
and
out.
Another thing I think is really important is to really watch the word "we," because one of the jokes I like to tell is that a friend of mine called up and said, "How much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq?" I'm like, "Oh my God, we're in Iraq? I thought we're in Northern California."
Oh my God! I've read the Constitution many times. I've never seen the word "me" or "I" in that Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
My point actually is a different one. Which my point I'm trying to make is not it's not okay to say "we." My point is, and the rest of that joke. Is that then my friend says, "Well, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq?" And I said, "I got troops? Holy shit, would I tell them? If I tell them to take out the Grand Coulee, will they blow it up for me?" You know, my point is that it's really dangerous,
very,
I think.
Thank you very much for your insight.
Okay.
And
great.
I hope we can find solutions for the problems you brought forth.
785 is waiting online, Derek.
Great.
So
okay.
This is the guy that was talking about growing quail. Are you there?
Okay, great.
Yeah, hello.
Hey.
Hey, Derek, go ahead. I'd love for you to finish your comments and ideas, and then we can talk.
Okay, great. Well, my point was just that I think it's like all of my American Indian friends say that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our own hearts and minds. And one of the things to do with that is to separate ourselves from this culture and to not say "we," to recognize that the government doesn't have my best interests at heart, and to be able to stay, you know, that's over there, that's them. I'm here, they're there. And would the, did Tecumseh, when he was fighting back, did he say, you know, "We're moving into Ohio"? No, we're not moving into Ohio. They're moving into Ohio. So I'm not Shell Oil. I'm not ExxonMobil. I'm not Monsanto. And I'm not George Bush. And
neither is 785 or me.
Yeah. And so the point is that I think it's really important to separate and to make sure that we talk about it. It's not my economy. It's their economy. Because as soon as they get me to say it's my economy, I've bought into it. Yes, I have to participate in it, but that's because I can't go 30 yards from where I am right now and go pull some salmon out of the stream because those people, the word I can't say tonight, those people have killed the salmon, and there are very, very few salmon. I've seen baby salmon in the stream. But now if I want to eat salmon, I have – I mean, if I want to eat, I can't just go out right behind my home and catch salmon. And I didn't do that. It's like I was talking to this American Indian friend of mine several years ago, and I said, oh, God, I feel so bad because I drive. I'm causing global warming. And she said, you know, you didn't create the system. Don't take responsibility for what you didn't make. You were dropped into the system. Yes, you can take responsibility for driving, but that's not key. What you need to do is to stop car culture. And stopping car culture by not driving is a very, very short lever. And the question really is, and I actually got this question. Okay, so here's the thing is that the question we really need to ask ourselves is the world a better place because you were born? Have you made the world a better place? And this is what all creatures did outside of this culture. How do you think this world, this beautiful world, got to be so beautiful and resilient? It's because every salmon made the world a better place by being born. Every tree made the world a better place by just by existing. I mean, that's what you do. That's what a salmon does. A salmon would carry nutrients up and be eaten by a bear, and then the bear would shit in the forest, and those nutrients would go up into the tree. And there's a very, very strong relation with these. Or a chickadee. A chickadee makes the forest better by simply existing, because they've actually done studies where if you remove chickadees from a forest, trees grow like 40% slower because of insects. And that's what everybody does, is make the world a better place simply by existing. And the question is, but industrial humans don't. And so the question is, do you make the world, how do you make the world a better place because you were born? And then there's a friend of mine from Kansas, Terry Schuster, who says that the next part of this is any action that you're going to do, is it more helpful to the world than you killing yourself? And so that's why the simple living thing is good, but it's not the answer. Because if you really think that simple living is the answer, then just kill yourself. But we can do things that are better than that, like the relocalization. That's a great thing. Anyway, so that's my whole point, is that the answer is not to simply withdraw, but we need to stop this system from killing the planet. Okay,
hello.
So I'm done.
All right, hello. Am I on?
You're on.
You
guys?
Okay,
you
guys. Okay, good. Hey, Derek. So we are doing our best around here to relocalize, to build our own self-sustainable communities. I mean, that's what we would much rather have that than anything. I mean, I'd rather make my own food than rely on somebody else, because pasteurization and all the other things that are involved, creating cancer and these chemicals these farmers around here dump on the fields, I do not like it very much at all. But as far as the rest of the world, you know, I know that I can survive, and I can help my neighbors, and we can survive and get along, you know, we'll do just fine. But we're mostly concerned for the rest of the world and the rest of the larger scale, you know, the bigger cities, you know, that's what we're surrounded by. We still live out here, and there's no cities, and there's not a large amount of people, but the cities are encroaching and coming in, and they're growing ever closer to our small communities that have existed here for, I'm a fifth generation fella around here, and we're getting closer and closer, but yet we want to do everything we can to make everything good for people and for the long term, but yet we see the economy and the world futures and especially in the corruption in the government. As far as me to voice my opinion, what I predict and what I see is that the economy is going to collapse.
Absolutely.
Big bankers are going to move out of the country. They're going to take their money and run, and we're going to be left here. And the only, like I said earlier, the only trading card, the only thing we're good at, the thing that we come across are the big pond in boats, and we come over here and we had the skills to survive, which a lot of it had to do with growing food, growing beef, and, you know, so what are we going to fall back to? We can make food, and we got a lot, you know, it's known that we have good soil. We produce grain for the entire world, so I think that's going to be one of our big trading cards.
But why do you want to have a trading card? Why do you need a trading card? Why do you need a trading
card? Well, that's been one of the that's the issue of the day, of the evening, is I think that we should just hit the reset button. The people of America should hit the reset button. Maybe we shouldn't trade it. We should keep it for a while and see what happens. I don't think we should trade. We should help each other.
reestablish the government.
Okay. No disagreement from me on that at all.
There's 913 is back. Let's see. They're gangbanging tonight, Derek.
Yes.
Hello.
We're gangbanging you. That's what my friend is. He's trying to explain something to you, and I call it the Great Depression. Now, we are going into a depression to make this, to clean the board, clean the plate. And my compadre on the other end of the line here, talking to you from Kansas, because I'm from Kansas also, is that he's like saying, you know, well, we're going to feed the world. We have all this good soil out here to make food and everything, but that's not the thing. The thing of it is that, you know, it's our government is getting made with a big eraser. It's called depression. And we're going to wipe out everything and start over again.
Who's we? We remember what Derek was saying earlier?
Yeah, and your government's doing all this? It's your fault? It's your fault they're in Iraq? Oh, man, you're a bad person.
Okay, you're right. It's not my government. It's the government that that we live under
government.
Right now.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
Right.
Right.
I don't agree with this government. I mean, I agree with the basic constitution that was founded to an extent. I mean, actually, at 32 members of the constitution were slave owners that signed the constitution. But
yeah, the whole three fifths of a human being thing, a little bit weird.
Yeah, that's sort of strange. But, I mean, come on, let's just get real here. When it all started, this whole our whole basic government was started on slave owners and economic failure back then.
On stolen land. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, yeah. So now here we are. 225 years later, trying to make sense out of it.
Right, I agree.
Yeah.
And I think that what's really important is to, is what the quail caller was talking about raising your own food. I think that that's absolutely crucial, and I think that that's an absolutely necessary thing on so many levels. That's why I was questioning the whole whether, and I'm not the only person who does this. Do you know, by the way, Fred Kirschenmann's work? Fred Kirschenmann is this great organic farmer out of North Dakota.
Yes.
And he's given so many talks. He's great. Anyway, that's one of the things he's been questioning for years is he keeps saying, you know, the U.S. is supposed to feed the world. Why? Why? I mean, because we all know that all these export food programs, they all destroy local economies over there. I mean, you know that, with you know, U.S. corn exports to Mexico destroying the local market for corn grown down there because of economy of scale and all that stuff. It's just the same. It's no different. It's just, you know, Tyson is doing internal colonization just like Tyson or just like, you know, ADM or Cargill. Do external colonization.
Excuse me, Tyson is a poultry producer, right?
Yeah, and that's what I was saying, is they do internal colonization because I worked with some chicken farmers, well, people who used to be chicken farmers, who now have to, basically they're employees of Tyson who have to buy the chicks from them, raise them under certain conditions, sell them back at prices determined by Tyson. Actually, some of them were in that region, a little bit east in Arkansas. And the point is that...
Derek, you want to hear a funny story?
Okay. Sure.
Okay. When I was 16 years old, I worked for Thompson's Poultry Farm.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, 16. You said 16, right?
16 years old. And I was a chicken packer.
Mm-hmm.
And these chickens would come off of these big conveyor belts and drop down in my little bin, and I have to pack the chickens in these boxes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Tyson's came up and bought us out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing changed. Except, you know, we had more chickens coming in. I just thought it was funny that you meant Pisces. But my point is that we can't feed the world.
Absolutely. I agree. And the world doesn't want to be fed. It's like I interviewed a member of the Tupac Amaristas, the MRTA, the revolutionary group, down in Peru.
Peru? Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I asked was, what do you want from the people of Peru? And his answer was really great, which is, we want to be able to grow and distribute our own food. We already know how to do so. We already know how to do that. We merely need to be allowed to do so. And that's really the point. That's the whole struggle right there, is for people to be allowed to grow and distribute their own food communally. And you can't do that when you have these multinational conglomerates coming in and then the government backing up with force of arms, backing up your the forced insertion of the other foodstuffs.
That's wonderful, wonderful ideas. That is beautiful. That is the best thing. I mean, that is the most truth right there. That the government is stopping us from doing what's best for us.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, I think we ought to all get tillers and make our own gardens, man.
But we're doing that now.
I think that's an absolutely crucial thing. I think that's one of the things that we can do.
I agree. I'm not being sarcastic or anything.
Neither am I.
Yeah, you know,
neither am I.
Dead serious.
I absolutely agree. Mm-hmm.
People should grow their own food.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a controversial position. I've let my brothers and comrades here speak tonight. And I want to ask you a question, a controversial one, I think, for me. Professor Noam Chomsky from MIT, you know who he is, he said that to follow some of this line of logic that you're pursuing philosophically, and I think it's happening in the real world anyhow, he says that it would make us party to committing genocide. I think he used the word genocide in his criticism, and I got that from, I think it was on your Wikipedia page, by the way. What do you say?
I got to look at that. That's one of the things that pisses me off. This has happened before, and I haven't looked at Wikipedia for a while. But it pisses me off because people who hate my work keep hijacking it, and that's.
Well, I don't want to make you mad, Derek, but I read that,
I'm not mad at you. I mean, I've heard that before, and I actually have a response to it, which is that. Actually, I'm going to read something. This is something I talk about every time because it's a really important point. I think that, I mean, part of that quote too. Do you have the quote in front of you? Because the end of that quote is actually quite racist.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, because one of the things he says is that nobody wants to live as hunter-gatherers. He actually says that there. And it's like, oh, you know what? Actually, hunter-gatherers want to live as hunter-gatherers. And
that's
they
bullshit.
Fight with their lives.
Oh, you're saying Chomsky's saying that nobody wants to live like the Indians or hunter-gatherers are not real people or something, right?
Well, he says that nobody wants to live that way. And we won't live that way. But the truth is, I mean, there is only one way of life that's sustainable, and that is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we'll be there again someday, because any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. I mean, it takes...
I agree.
Basically, it takes a rocket scientist is the only person who could, or, you know, a CEO or something, is the only person who could possibly think you can have a way of life, or an economist, or a lunatic, are the only people who could think that you could, insofar as there's a difference between you, who could think that you can have a way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources that will last. Anyway, so here's the point, is that there are more people on this planet than the planet can support. There will someday be far fewer people on the planet than there are now. And what do you do with the fact that if you allow this system to continue, you're committing mass murder? And what do you do with the fact that if you stop this culture from continuing, you're committing mass murder? There's a bunch of answers to this. One of them, none of which, I mean, that's one of my problems. And I respect so much of Chomsky's work. I'm not going to attack him. But one of the things that's wrong with that is it's not his comment is not very well thought out, because first off, what people is he talking about? Is he talking about salmon people, polar bear people, prairie dog people? Is he talking about bobwhite people? So is he talking about traditional indigenous
people? Well, you know what? I like what Chauncey said.
Well, Mark, you interrupted Derek, but I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So first off, it's what people are you talking about? Second, are we talking about, even if we're only keeping ourselves to human beings, are we talking about subsistence farmers in India? No. I asked Anuradha Mittal, who's a former director of Food First, if the people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. And she laughed and said, of course. And there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. So it's crap to say that. I mean, would the 60% of the people in the world who currently have no electricity, would the people of the Niger Delta be better off if the global economy disappeared? Of course they would, because they're subsistence farmers, they're subsistence fishermen, fisherwomen, and Chevron oil, Shell oil, are destroying their land. Would the indigenous people in South America be better off if Chevron were kicked out of their land? Of course they would. So my point, first off, is what people are we talking about? We need to be specific about that. You do not need electricity to survive. You need clean water and clean food to survive. And the people who come after are not going to give a shit as to whether we were nice people. They're not going to give a shit as to whether we relocalized. They're not going to give a shit as to whether we voted Democrat, Republican. They're not going to give a shit as to what we did. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. And we can all fantasize about some magical transformation or about some technotopia, but technotopias aren't going to happen. But we can all fantasize about some eco-groovy socialist utopia, and if you can't breathe the air and drink the water, it doesn't matter. So the first thing is, what Chomsky forgets is that there is a real physical world, and the real physical world comes first. And the real physical world, the health of the real physical world, is the most important thing in the world. Because there is such a thing called carrying capacity. And if you have too many rabbits on a piece of ground, rabbits are going to die off. And if you have too many humans for the planet to support, humans are going to die off. This is going to happen. And I'm not being callous with this. I need to say, I am going to die in the crash. I will die. There is no doubt. Two reasons. One is because as soon as those in power, somebody asked John Stockwell once he was a CIA agent who started exposing the CIA. Somebody said, well, if everything you say is true, why haven't they killed you? And his answer was really straightforward, because they're winning. I have no illusions. I mean, there are already – I have no illusions about this. There are those in federal prosecutors' offices who hate my work. And when things start to come down, when they start to lose, I'm dead. And everybody who's doing anything important is dead. I have no illusions about that. But even if they don't, even if they don't touch me, it doesn't matter, because I have something called Crohn's disease, which is this horrible, horrible disease that gives you pretty much constant diarrhea, and it's eating away my guts. And right now, the thing that's keeping me alive is a high-tech medicine. And when that medicine isn't available, I'm dead. But the truth is, my life, my little life, is not important as important as the health of the land base. That is the problem right there. It's the belief that any human life is more important than the health of the land. But anyway, back to the original point, when this system comes down, the rural poor, the world over, will be better off immediately. And you and your community will be better off immediately. The people in cities aren't going to encroach. The urban poor are really going to be in trouble. And I am not in any way diminishing their plight, which is horrible. And that's what any abusive system does. What any abusive system does is it makes the victims dependent upon the abuser, because if you're not made dependent upon the abuser, then there is no reason, nobody in their right mind would stay a victim if their alternative support systems had not been erased. And so that's all really important. But another thing that's really important is, as the system comes down, I can guarantee that about 100% of the misery is going to be caused because those whose lifestyles are killing the planet attempt to maintain those lifestyles to the bitter end. And one of the examples of this is, we always hear the world's running out of water and people are starving, dying of thirst and blah, blah, blah. And that's true, they're dying of thirst, but that's not because the world's running out of water. They're dying of thirst because the water is being stolen. Because 90% of the water used by human beings is used for agriculture and industry, 90%. So people who are dying of thirst in Ethiopia, the chances are really good that there's a lima bean farm right nearby that's exporting lima beans to Europe, or that there's a semiconductor factory that's – or here's a good example. In Ghana, there's dams for bauxite to smelt aluminum into beer cans. And it's the same with food, that about 80% of the countries experiencing famine at any point are exporting food. They're exporting cash crops. And the same was true in the famous Irish potato famine. Ireland was exporting grain at the same time. And so, I mean, if all the dams on the Colorado River suddenly failed and the Colorado River once again reached the ocean, how weird would that be? The capitalist press would bray as one that, oh, my God, all these people are going to die of thirst. But I wouldn't want to hear one word of complaint as long as there existed a single irrigated citrus orchard, a single irrigated alfalfa field, a single irrigated dairy, a single single golf course, a single lawn, a swimming pool, as long as Las Vegas still exists with like 2 million people. I mean, the same amount of water is used by municipal golf courses as is used by municipal human beings. And so my point is that there is all this huge waste, and I mean, as soon as Chomsky starts addressing that, then we can talk about the other. But then here's the real point. Here's what I want to get to. The whole thing was just a preamble to get to this. Something I want to read, which is something from my book Endgame, is what do we do with the fact that you know, if we act, we're involved in mass murder, and if we don't act, we're involved in mass murder. And for now, I've got an answer. If you've gotten this far in this book, or if you're simply anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization's going to crash, whether or not we help bring that about. If you don't agree with that, we probably have nothing to say to each other. How about Joey Gathright? He's pretty good this year, isn't he? Anyway, we probably also agree that this crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with all this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical world helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize, that the civilization is going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan, they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or appropriate channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams. We need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to protest and chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants do, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water. We need how to build shelters. All this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge. It can look like starting gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs. And it can look like teaching people how to sing. So my point is that, with all this, is that...
1 minute,
what
Derek.
What Chomsky is ignoring is that the population will someday be lower than it is now. And every cell in my body wants for it to be a voluntary transformation. But I know it's not going to be. And so what we need to do is to protect the land, to make sure that something survives this horrid, wretched blowout that is this culture.
Derek Jensen, we're bringing our tribes to Ottawa, Kansas.
Good.
You hear me?
Yeah.
We're bringing our tribes to Ottawa, Kansas. You've
How
been talking to my brothers. I've got 1 minute left in our program. Derek
okay.
Jensen, you have saved my ass.
Oh, thank God.
I'm going to go out and talk to my brothers, the people that just called you tonight, and we're going to bring our tribes to Ottawa, Kansas, and see you.
Good deal.
Well, Derek, here's to the Phoenix.
Yeah,
here's to what?
Right. The Phoenix.
The Phoenix.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yep.
May we come from the ashes and rebuild our civilization.
Okay,
yep.
So what?
Yep.
All right. The show is going down, folks. Derek,
okay,
good night.
Have a great night. Good night.
Hello.
Thank you, Derek. Yeah, hello.
Hey.
I'm still here.
Derek.
Yeah.
Rest assured, my friend, we have the best intentions and good hearts and lots of integrity and energy, and we're going to work our tails off to make sure that we can do what we can, and we're going to persevere. And
30 seconds, brother.
Yeah, we're gonna do our best, and we're with you, man. We're with you.
You know,
lots of people are.
I thank you, and I have to tell you that some of my favorite people in the world that I've ever worked with are family farmers. There are some of the just strongest, most intelligent, most revolutionary people I've ever met.
We got 30 seconds, brother.
I got to tell you something.
Yeah, you're talking to one right there. I'll tell you straight up, Derek, the clock's ticking right now. But, brother, thank you so much for talking and being so patient with my friends. I appreciate it.
Fine.
Are you there? Okay, Derek, and I promise you we'll all be down there. I'll drag as many people as I can.
Oh, that sounds great.
I can't wait to see you, Derek. I'm so happy you talked. And thank
you
for putting
up with us. Come up to me right before the talk. And I will go ahead and get all my swearing out of the way real quick so I can do it in private
All right, brother.
And then talk about in the chapel.
Radio.
Okay, anything else? You still there?
That isn't just the sound of the all-new 2016 Mercedes-Benz GLC being put through its paces. It's the sound of innovation. The innovation behind one of the most advanced SUVs on the road today. With multiple driving modes, a suite of intelligent drive systems, and a technology-filled cabin that sets new standards in modern luxury. This is what innovation sounds like. Now, discover what it feels like in a 2016 Mercedes-Benz GLC.
Some equipment described as optional.